The group, crowded into Shala Sahi's apartment, spent the entire day, Thanksgiving Day, going over the plan. With several different components, everything had to occur perfectly for maximum effect. They listened intently as Sheikh Mushaf al-Mukhari explained the plan again.
Car bombs will be placed here, 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 and here.
Al-Mukhari pointed to the map spread on Shala's kitchen table. He drew red dots at the site of each bombing.
A police station. A post office. To strike at American bureaucracy. A bank. To strike at the American economy. And this last one...
A daycare center?
The Sheikh looked up at her.
You are not wavering in your zeal to serve Allah, are you?
No, of course not. Not at all.
Hamed wasn't sure he believed her. This was a perfect example of why women could not be trusted to play an important part in this holy war. They were too weak, too emotional. Instead of being clear-eyed servants of the Prophet, they allowed their feelings to influence their actions.
And a daycare center to strike at the hearts of the Americans. To make them feel the same pain untold thousands of our people feel at the loss of our children. Not only to American guns and bombs, but to the satanic culture that seduces them away from the true tenets of Islam.
But these explosions, they're only a prelude, yes?
Yes, a prelude. So the Americans will take us seriously when we take over the ultra-megamart and issue our demands.
The timeline was straightforward. The bombs would go off at 9:45 on Friday morning, when targets such as the bank, the post office, and the daycare center were busy. Then, 15 minutes later, at 10 o'clock, the group of heavily armed sleeper cell Hizbut Tahrir agents would take over the ultra-megamart, killing anyone who stood in their way. There would be hundreds, perhaps thousands, of shoppers inside the sprawling store and only 20 warriors, but that would be enough. The plan called for them to enter the store individually, along with the crush of Americans, starting when the doors opened at 6 a.m. The 4 hours before they struck would give them plenty of time to move throughout the store and plant the small but powerful bombs they carried at every entrance point. Once armed, the bomb's delicate sensors would trigger if a large number of people approached from outside, like a force of American police or military. Of course, the Americans might think about trying to trigger them in some fashion so they could launch an attack once the bombs went off, but they would reconsider when they saw the hostages secured right next to each of the explosive devices. The Americans would not deliberately blow up any of their own people, especially on camera. And there would be plenty of cameras, Hamed thought, once the Sheikh contacted the American news media and issued the group's demands. Demand, actually, because there was really only one. All United States presence, military, corporate, what have you, must withdraw from Islamic soil. American business interests in Muslim countries must be turned over immediately, not to the governments of those countries, but rather to the Caliphate, the new Islamic order to unite all Muslims everywhere and lead them to their rightful place of dominance in the world. If what it took to accomplish that goal was the death of every infidel on the planet, then so be it. But kicking the Americans out must be the first step. Their godless power would be broken. They would give in. Or else, Hamed and his comrades would detonate the dirty briefcase nuke Mukhari brought with him. In that case, where the ultra-megamart now stood, would be nothing but a radioactive crater, a blight on the already ugly Texas prairie, a blight lasting hundreds of years. Yes, Hamed thought, the plan was simple, but there were plenty of things involved that could go wrong. They would need the blessings of the Prophet to strike this blow for jihad, this opening gambit in the rise of the Caliphate. Hamed was confident they would have those blessings. Allah would not desert them now, not when they were so close to their goal.
What's the verdict, Doc?
Lawrence Fargo Ford and Ambassador Keane sat in the ambassador's office as the American Embassy in Islamabad's chief medical officer relayed his report over the ambassador's speakerphone.
How long is he going to be out?
It's impossible to say. By doing surgery, we were able to stop the bleeding in his brain and repair the fracture in his skull. But Mr. Parker's brain is still swollen. In all likelihood, the swelling will have to go down before he regains consciousness. That could be a few hours, days, even weeks or months. We just can't predict something like that.
Ford and Ambassador Keane traded looks.
Thank you, Doctor. I'm sure you did the very best you could under the circumstances.
I don't mind telling you, I should have performed that surgery in an American hospital rather than a Pakistani facility. It would have helped to have a real neurosurgeon, too. But even though everything wasn't state-of-the-art, we managed to get the job done.
When can he be moved back here to the embassy?
Not for several days, and he probably shouldn't be moved even then. Is that all?
Yes, thank you. I take it you have Mr. Parker under guard.
As best I can, with Pakistani security forces. I can't very well surround his room with United States Marines, much as I'd like to. Might offend our hosts, and not offending anybody seems to be the most important consideration in Washington these days. Wouldn't want to damage our standing in the world community again so soon after it started to be repaired.
The president you're disparaging appointed me to this position, you know.
Ford spread his hands.
Disparaging? Who said I'm disparaging anybody?
I know how you people feel about her.
You people? That's sort of a discriminatory thing to say, isn't it, Mr. Ambassador?
You know what I mean. You company men who think you know more about what's in the country's best interests than the people who were elected to lead it.
Let's just say sometimes we have a better grasp of the real world. And here's something from that real world for you, Mr. Ambassador. Islamic terrorists are planning to attack a target inside the United States, and we don't know what it is. Parker risked his life to bring us that intel, then lost consciousness before he could pass it along.
I understand that.
Have you told Washington about it?
What is there to tell? We don't have any concrete evidence of anything. Your people haven't managed to decipher the documents Parker was carrying, have they?
Not yet. The blood they were soaked in obliterated a lot of the writing. The blood Parker shed in getting it here, I'd remind you.
You don't have to remind me.
We've been able to make out words here and there, enough to tell that it's some sort of operational plan. But we haven't figured out what the target is. That means Parker is probably the only one who knows, at least on our side.
All we can do is wait for him to regain consciousness.
Oh, yeah, that's all well and good. Except for the fact he said the attack was going to take place the day after Thanksgiving.
Keane glanced at his watch.
Well, it's nearly Friday morning in the States.
Yeah, I know. That's why I sent a signal of my own to Washington.
You went over my head?
Sorry, Mr. Ambassador. Homeland Security and my bosses at Langley had to be alerted. They'll keep it on the down low so they won't cause a panic. But at least this way the authorities will have some warning.
Ford left for the hospital. Walt Graham carried a little more weight through the midsection these days than when he was playing power forward for Texas A&M, but he liked to think he wasn't that far out of playing shape. He knew he could still whip his son in a game of driveway one-on-one, but he had to admit he was more winded afterward, and sometimes his knees ached. He wasn't old, though. Far from it. He was in the prime of life, and an FBI agent, just as he always dreamed of being. He had a pretty, loving wife and three fine kids. Life was good. More than enough reason right there to be worried. "Nothing gold can stay," some poet said. Robert Frost? Graham couldn't recall for sure, but he remembered the line from one of his college literature courses and knew it was true. Life starts looking too rosy. You better run for the damn hills, because all hell was probably about to break loose. Knowing that, Graham didn't feel the least bit surprised when he walked into the Dallas office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation at 5 o'clock in the morning and saw the upset expression on the face of Eileen Bastrop, the assistant special agent in charge who called him at 4:15 and asked if he could come to the office.
What is it, Eileen?
This came in about an hour ago.
Somebody with a long memory for old comic strips once referred to them as Mud and Jeff. Graham was 6'5", and Bastrop barely topped the 5-foot minimum height requirement for female agents. Of course, there were considerable differences between them other than their height. The most notable, he was a black man and she was a white woman, with such pale blonde hair, it almost appeared silver. Both were well-trained, highly competent agents, though, and all business most of the time. When they overheard the Mutt and Jeff line, the glares they both sent at the perpetrator ensured it never happened again. Graham scanned the facts. Though the words it contained were shocking, no shock was visible on his face. But he was feeling it inside. He looked up from the curling paper.
This isn't a false alarm, is it, Eileen?
Who knows how these things will turn out? There have been plenty of warnings in the past that came to nothing. This could be another one. But we have to take it seriously either way.
Oh, I take it seriously, all right. I got a bad feeling in my gut about this one. Those crazy bastards have been waiting a long time to hit us again.
Eileen perched a hip on the edge of a desk. They were the only ones in the office at the moment. A couple of younger agents were holding down the fort on the graveyard shift. They called the ASAC when the high-priority fax arrived from Langley. And once Eileen saw what was going on, she sent the kiddies down to the break room so she could talk this over in private with the special agent in charge.
What now, Walt?
We follow protocol. Notify the anti-terrorism people at all the local law enforcement agencies, as well as the state troopers and the Texas Rangers. Tell them to keep things as quiet as possible. We don't want a panic on our hands.
The news media will get the story anyway.
They always do.
If it bleeds, it leads. Freedom of the press and all that.
Oh, I believe in freedom of the press. I surely do. But it wouldn't hurt those folks to show a little common sense every once in a while.
Might hurt the ratings or the circulation numbers, and that would anger the gods of the bottom line.
We could commiserate all day about the sorry state of the mainstream media, Eileen, and it wouldn't change a blasted thing. Get the Boy Scouts back in here and get them to work on the phones.
Will do, boss. It's more work for us now that all the different agencies try to share their intel, isn't it?
Yeah, but it gets better results. I think I got a turkey hangover. I didn't want to wake up when the phone rang. Didn't much want to crawl out of a warm bed with my wife next to me either.
We all have to make sacrifices.
Graham knew Eileen Bastrop lived alone, didn't have any family in the area, didn't have a steady boyfriend. He wasn't sure if she even dated anybody. Most of the time, he figured the FBI was pretty much her life. Every so often, he wondered what she did for fun, but that was none of his business. She was a damned fine agent. That was all that really mattered. Graham went into his private office while Bastrop and the two young agents got busy alerting the local law enforcement agencies about the terrorist threat. He took the facts with him and studied it, trying to parse more meaning out of the simple words. The intel Langley received from one of the CIA's agents overseas was sketchy. There was a confirmed threat from Hizb ut-Tahrir, not just against American interests, but against American soil. Bastards wanted to hit us again, somewhere right in our own backyard. But where exactly, nobody knew. So the word went out to the entire country. Be on the alert. Be ready for trouble. The enemy is out there, and he's poised to strike.
Lord help us if we're not ready for him.
The stalkers worked around the clock for days, getting merchandise on the shelves in all the departments. Cash registers and barcode scanners were tested and retested, calibrated and recalibrated. Electricians finished up last-minute wiring jobs. Plumbers tightened the connections on toilets in the restrooms. Here and there, a little more fresh paint went on. The floors were mopped and buffed. Frozen foods and perishables were carted in and put in the proper places. Outside on the parking lot, the last stripes and arrows were painted on the asphalt. More than 100 people labored through the night to put all the finishing touches on the spanking new store. As long as 2 football fields behind a massive parking lot, it ran roughly north and south on the west side of the interstate. The property was located at the top of a long, fairly gentle rise. Looking to the south, one could see the skyline of Fort Worth in the distance. To the north lay the vast sprawl of Alliance Airport, and beyond it, also visible from the high ground, rose the grandstands of Texas Motor Speedway, the NASCAR track. Stretching for miles along either side of the highway were residential and retail developments, but this was perhaps the prime piece of real estate in the area, easily accessible by millions of people, and the advertising blitz made certain every one of those people knew the store was having its grand opening today. There would be no shakedown opening to get the bugs out. When the door slid back for the general public at 6 a.m., it would be for the first time ever. Minnesota claimed the Mall of America. Texas was going it one better. The Lone Star State bagged the first Ultra Megamart. Hiram Stackhouse wasn't finished either. On several thousand acres around the store, he planned to build restaurants and hotels, apartment complexes, even a golf course and resort. Anything anybody would ever need or want would be found right here by the time Stackhouse was through. And this would be only the first in a series of such complexes he would build all across the country, ensuring him a lasting legacy as America's greatest entrepreneur. Maybe the greatest of all time. The lights illuminating the parking lot could be seen for miles in the pre-dawn darkness. Normally, the interstate wasn't too busy at this hour, but today a river of automotive steel stretched as far as the eye could see in both directions as traffic backed up on the highway. Shoppers waiting to get into the parking lot lined the frontage roads, and those lines spilled over onto the exit ramps and shoulders of the highway itself. Security guards waved flashlights and directed traffic, but getting that many cars off the road and into the parking lot was a slow process. Once shoppers finally found a place to park, they left their cars and joined the lines in front of the store's five main entrances. They would have lined up on the loading dock and gone in through the service entrance if they could, but guards were posted at the rear corners of the store to keep unauthorized people from venturing back there. The doors were still closed and locked, but after 6 o'clock came, they never would be again, except on Christmas Day. Other than that, the store would be open 24 hours a day, every day of the year, including Thanksgiving, Easter, and 4th of July. It was like a holiday in the parking lot this morning. The bright lights, the crowds, the sense of anticipation in the air. Everything made it seem a little like Christmas morning, as everyone waited anxiously to unwrap the shiny new Ultra Megamart store. Later in the day, Hiram Stackhouse himself would be here. Bands would play, Hiram would give away merchandise, there would be free food and drink, within reason, of course, and the celebration would just grow larger as the day went on. But for now, people just wanted to get in there and see what bargains they could grab. News choppers from the local TV stations circled overhead, sending back live shots of the crowd for their morning shows. No doubt more than one news director wished the crowd would get so impatient to start shopping they would rush the door, starting a riot. What great footage that would be. Visions of local news Emmys and triumphant ratings books danced in their heads. The constantly growing crowd was well-behaved, though, and nothing of the sort happened. Sure, folks were eager to get inside and start shopping, but a spirit of camaraderie extended through the mass of people. They were all in this together, and years from now, they could tell their children and grandchildren they were there when the Ultra Megamart opened its doors for the first time. Talk about your historic occasions. Full of excitement, Ronnie McCabe found it hard to believe she and her mother would be among the first shoppers in the first Ultra Megamart.
Do you really think Dad's gonna show up?
Ronnie and Terry stood in line in front of the store's middle entrance, about 100 yards from the doors.
He said he would. He usually keeps his word, if he can.
Yeah, but I know how much he hates crowds and shopping.
He doesn't hate it. He just has that typical male gene that prevents him from understanding how important shopping is.
Terry checked her watch. Just a couple minutes to go before the doors opened. Jack wasn't supposed to get here until 8 o'clock, which meant Terry and Ronnie would have to kill a couple of hours until he arrived. Well, that shouldn't prove too difficult. It would probably take them a while to even get inside the store. And once they were there, the aisles would be crowded. No point in getting in a hurry. She and Ronnie could afford to take their time. When you came right down to it, they had all day. Allison Sawyer knew that the doors must have swung open. She looked at her watch and saw the digital readout said 5:59. Either the watch was a little slow, or the Ultra Megamart employees jumped the gun by a minute or so. She didn't care. The only thing that mattered was soon she would be inside and could start shopping for Nate's Christmas presents. She kept a tight grip on her purse, with her arm wound through the strap to make it even more difficult for anybody to snatch it away from her. She had put money aside for months now. Not easy to do when her salary as an assistant manager at a movie theater didn't do much more than cover their bills every month, and she had $148 saved up to spend on her son. Right now, it seemed all the money in the world to her. Nate didn't even open his eyes when she carried him next door and left him sleeping on the neighbor's sofa. With luck, she might be back at the apartment before he woke up. That seemed pretty unlikely, though, as she looked around her at the crowd. Barricades were set up at the store entrances to funnel people into manageable lines, so there wouldn't be a dangerous stampede when the doors opened. Those lines were moving slowly. The one Allison was in hadn't budged yet. Like a long line of cars at a traffic light, it took a while for everybody to start moving once the light turned green, or in this case, once the doors to the Ultra Megamart opened.
Come on, come on.
People were already in there, grabbing up the good stuff. All Allison could do was hope there would be enough left over for her when she finally made her way into the store. She didn't want anything to ruin Nate's Christmas. There ought to be a law, Ellis Burke thought. A law against greedy, stupid people. Of course, if there was, the legal system in Texas would be even more bogged down than it already was, because then cops would spend all their time arresting people for being rednecks. He wished he got here earlier. But judging from the crowds in the parking lot and in front of the doors, he would have had to arrive before 5 o'clock to be anywhere close to getting in. He was just going to have to stand here with all these yokels and wait his turn. That annoyed the hell out of him. He deserved better than that. He wasn't one of the mob. Looking around himself today, though, maybe he was.
At least it's not cold and raining.
The temperature was probably in the upper 40s, just chilly enough for a jacket. Doors were open and lines were moving, also a plus. Burke shuffled along with the thousands of other would-be shoppers. To occupy his mind, he tried estimating how many people were in line in front of him and how fast the line was moving, so he could make some sort of educated guess about how soon he would reach the doors and be able to go on inside. Before long, he gave it up as a hopeless task. There were just too many people. He couldn't keep up with all of them.
Where the hell are they all gonna go once they're inside the store?
Sure, the place was big, but was it big enough to hold everybody who was out here? Of course, some shoppers would be leaving as others went in, but it might take a while for that ebb and flow effect to kick in. Most of them probably planned to spend at least an hour on their shopping, maybe more. In an hour or two, would so many people try to crowd in there without enough people leaving so all the space would get full? Burke got this crazy image in his head of the walls of the Ultra Mega Mart beginning to swell, to bulge out more and more, until finally they couldn't stand the strain any longer and they exploded outward, spewing rednecks in every direction and a tidal wave of blue jeans and gimme caps.
Stop him!
That jolted the bizarre image out of Burke's head. He started to look around.
Oh my God! What's that man doing? What's he got? Stop him, for God's sake! Somebody! Stop him!
The woman doing the yelling was heavyset, middle-aged, and black. Her right hand clutched the hand of a little boy. The left pointed, finger jabbing forward as she shouted.
Stop him! Stop him!
A man hurried toward Burke at a pace halfway between a walk and a run. He was in his early 20s, one of those skinny goth kids dressed all in baggy black clothes, the lank hair falling around his face, dyed an unnatural shade of black to match his garb. All that darkness made the doughy pallor of his face more pronounced. His frantic eyes locked for a second with Burke's, and in that second, Burke saw the multiple studs in both ears and the one right below the guy's mouth. His tongue was probably pierced too. Thankfully, Burke couldn't see that. He saw the woman's purse the guy was trying to stuff under his bulky jacket, though. What sort of dumbass would try to snatch a woman's purse in the middle of a huge crowd like this? That was Burke's first thought. Maybe it wasn't such a stupid move after all. Nobody was trying to stop the guy, despite the black woman's screams. Burke figured the purse belonged to her. The crowd was so thick that if nobody did anything, within moments the thief would be swallowed up by the mob. Yeah, he was pretty distinctive looking, but surely he wasn't the only goth kid here this morning. If he passed the purse off to a more normal-looking Confederate, there wouldn't be any way to prove he did anything wrong. All it took to pull off something like this was steady nerves, a certain amount of daring, and a bunch of sheep. People who didn't give a damn, didn't want to be involved, just wanted to get in the store and turn over more of their money to a modern-day robber baron like Hiram Stackhouse. Well, it was somebody else's lookout, thought Burke, not his. Then, some hot soccer mom blonde stepped in front of the purse snatcher.
Hold it! What do you think you're doing?
She reached for the purse and tried to drag it out from under the thief's leather jacket.
Hey, lady!
The goth kid gave the blonde a hard shove.
Bug off!
A pretty brown-haired teenager got in the guy's face.
Leave my mom alone!
The girl shoved the goth kid right back. Then the guy popped the teenager with a backhand, grabbed the hot blonde mom and slung her out of the way, and tried to force his way into the crowd again. That put him right in Burke's face. Burke didn't think about what he was doing. He just drew back his right fist at his side and planted it in the thief's midsection as hard as he could. The guy's eyes widened and bulged out in surprise and pain. Burke noticed that one of the guy's eyebrows was pierced too. Burke hit him again, putting the second shot right where the first one landed. These were his first punches since grade school. His parents were firm believers in nonviolence and took little Ellis along to all of their protests and sit-ins, making sure he was raised to know how important it was to fight the man, but to do it peacefully. Nobody ever told him how good it would feel to hit some scuzzball in the belly. The thief dropped to his knees. The blonde and her daughter both started walloping him from behind, driving him the rest of the way to the asphalt. He curled up in a ball and put his arms over his head, even though nobody was trying to kick him. In fact, the crowd stepped back and gave him some room. Burke leaned down and took the stolen purse from him. As he was straightening, a couple of uniformed security guards shouldered through the press of people.
Hey! Drop that purse, mister!
He's not the thief!
The blonde pointed to the goth kid.
There's the one who stole the purse.
That's right, officer. I'm an attorney. I was just recovering a stolen property.
He stopped that man.
The excited black woman came up, dragging the little boy with her.
Just hauled off and gave him what for?
The second Rent-A-Cop stepped up.
You apprehended the thief, sir?
Burke shrugged and nodded toward the blonde and her daughter.
It was really more these ladies.
No, I'm afraid he would have gotten away from us. He would have gotten away with that purse if you hadn't stopped him.
Burke didn't mind being the center of attention in a courtroom. In fact, he always liked that. But he didn't care for the feeling of having a whole horde of Texas Yahoos staring at him in admiration, like he was Chuck Norris or the lone frickin' ranger stepping in to stop the bad guy. He wasn't even sure why he did what he did. It wasn't any of his business. Now he just wanted to get on into the store, buy the damn toy for his daughter, and get the hell out of here. With that in mind, he turned to the black woman and held the purse out to her.
Here you go, ma'am. No need to thank me.
That's not my purse.
It's not? But I thought you...
I just started hollering when I saw the man grab it away from another woman. Looked like it hurt her, too, the way her arm got jerked around by that strap. That ugly fellow wasn't just about to let it go, though.
The security guards lifted the thief to his feet and were ready to haul him into the store. That was one way to get in ahead of everybody else, Burke thought fleetingly as he looked at the black woman.
But if the purse isn't yours, who does it belong to?
It's mine.
Burke turned toward the voice behind him and saw the prettiest woman he had run across in a long time standing there with her hand out for the purse. Well, maybe it was a good thing he intervened after all, instead of letting the thief scurry on past him. After all, he was an officer of the court. It was his civic duty to uphold the law, particularly when such duty included making the acquaintance of a beautiful and grateful young woman. Allison was taken totally by surprise when she felt the hard tug on the purse strap and her arm wrenched around behind her back. She made a desperate grab at the strap, but too late. The purse was gone, and with it, the money she saved for her son's Christmas. A mixture of despair and outrage exploded in Allison's mind at the moment of realization. It was so powerful it froze her in place for a second. But only for a second. Then she began fighting to push her way through the crowd after the thief.
Stop that man! He stole my purse!
Nobody seemed to hear her. At least, nobody tried to stop the man who stole her purse.
Stop him!
Then, the woman who witnessed the theft added her voice to the outcry. It carried a lot better than Allison's. A couple of women got in the thief's way and slowed him down. Then a man hit him, knocking him to the ground. Because of the crowd, Allison couldn't see the man well at first. Now she was standing in front of him as he held the purse out toward her. She saw he was considerably older than she, around 40, she guessed. He was better dressed than most of the people waiting to get into the Ultra Mega Mart, in a conservative dark suit, a white shirt, and what Allison guessed was a power tie. She wasn't sure about that. He wasn't fat, just big and solidly built, with some streaks of gray in his dark hair, and the slightly flushed face of a man who liked to take a drink, or three or four, on a regular basis. He reminded Allison of her dad. The look in his eyes as he smiled at her wasn't paternal, though, or even avuncular.
Here's your purse, miss. Are you all right? Did he hurt you when he grabbed it?
Allison took the purse and then rubbed her arm.
No, he just jerked me around a little. I thought the way I had the purse strap wrapped around my arm, nobody could get it loose. But obviously I was wrong.
Well, if you're injured, you could file suit against the guy. I'd be glad to represent you. We'd win, I guarantee it.
He grinned as the security guards led the thief off through the crowd.
I'm not sure you'd ever be able to collect any judgment, though. Not unless you were willing to accept nose rings and eyebrow rings in lieu of cash.
This man was older than her. Old enough to be, well, her older brother anyway. And from what he just said, he was a lawyer to boot. Allison wasn't too fond of lawyers, having had a crappy one during her divorce. At least this one seemed to have a sense of humor.
I'm Ellis Burke, by the way.
Allison Sawyer.
She took the hand he held out to her and shook it, letting go quickly so his grip couldn't linger. She was used to guys hitting on her, especially once they found out she was divorced. And while she was grateful to Ellis Burke for helping her, she didn't want him getting any ideas.
Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Please call me Ellis. Ellis. Allison. Kinda goes together, don't you think?
Before she could respond to this blatant come-on, the older blonde woman who also helped stop the thief introduced herself.
I'm Terry McCabe, and this is my daughter, Ronnie.
I'm pleased to meet both of you.
Her gaze took in the two women and Burke.
I'd offer you a reward for helping me, but all I have is the money I've saved up for my son's Christmas presents.
A reward? Oh, nonsense. You don't owe us a thing.
Really, we were happy to help. I'm glad we were able to stop that man, so your son's Christmas won't be ruined.
You and me both, Mrs. McCabe.
So, how old is your son? And do you and your husband have any more children?
Allison knew what he was angling for, but she didn't see any way out of providing the information without being rude. She didn't want to do that. After all, Burke stopped the thief and saved her money.
Nate's 8 years old. He's my only child.
There. She neatly avoided having to tell Burke she was divorced, or so she thought. But she could tell he noticed she wasn't wearing a wedding ring. It must have emboldened him.
I know it's very difficult being a single mother these days. It's hard to make ends meet and still devote enough time to raising your child. I see it all the time in my practice.
You're a divorce lawyer?
Personal injury. That's right, I'm one of those ambulance-chasing shysters. There, I've said what you're all thinking, so we don't have to worry about it anymore, do we?
The uproar over the attempted purse-snatching had subsided. The lines were moving toward the doors again, and people's attention returned to the thing that brought them here. The press of the crowd kept Allison from thanking Burke again and moving on. She was sort of stuck there with him and Terry and Ronnie McCabe, as well as the black woman who introduced herself as Judy Winston. The little boy was her son, Darius. Allison tried to make small talk.
What brings you here before dawn on a chilly morning, Mr. Burke? Shouldn't you be getting ready for court?
The courts are all in recess until after the Thanksgiving weekend. No judge would dare interfere with the biggest shopping day of the year. And I guess I'm here for the same reason you are. Because of my kid.
Boy or girl?
A little girl. She's 12.
Do you and your wife have any other children?
No, just the one. But she's not my wife anymore. I'm divorced.
He didn't seem to mind saying it. Allison still had a little bit of a hard time with that sometimes.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. It was for the best. If someone doesn't want to be with a certain person anymore, no amount of rationalizing or denial will ever make them happy again. Once whatever it was between two people that drew them together is gone, they're both better off moving on.
That's sort of a cynical way to look at it, isn't it? If there's something wrong with a marriage, isn't it better to try to fix it?
Did you try to fix yours before you and your husband split up?
As a matter of fact, I did. I couldn't do it by myself, though. He wasn't willing to stop drinking or cheating on me.
Then he was a damn fool. And the fewer damn fools in your life, the better. That's the law. Burke's law.
Allison didn't see what was funny. He must have seen the puzzled look in her face.
It was a TV show, Burke's Law, about this millionaire who's a cop. Never mind, you're too young.
Allison felt slightly offended at that, but tried not to show it. She changed the subject, sort of.
That's all right. By the time we actually get into the store, I'm going to be old.
Let's just hope that when we get in there, it's worth waiting for.
With a weak flickering of the eyelids, Brad Parker's eyes opened. They didn't focus at first, but then they locked in on Ford.
Fargo? That you? What's going on?
Nothing to worry about, pal. I know you just woke up, Brad, but we've got to talk. You were telling me about what Hizb ut-Tahrir is going to pull in the States. You said there was going to be a terrorist attack, but you didn't say where. You've got to tell me where, Brad.
Day after Thanksgiving.
Ford grimaced. It was already Friday morning in the United States, anywhere from 10:30 to 7:30, depending on the time zone involved. Although Parker wasn't able to find the exact time of the terrorist attack, they already knew the day. Now they needed the location, so they could try to prevent it, if there was still time.
Where, Brad? Where?
Texas. Mega Mart. Ultra Mega Mart.
His eyes closed again. He was still alive. The machines testified to that. But he was unconscious again. And Ford was left standing there.
Ultra Mega Mart? What the hell?
He knew what Mega Mart was, of course. But he never heard of Ultra Mega Mart. Somebody in Washington would know, though, or could find out, as soon as Ford got back to the embassy and sent a radio message bouncing off a satellite. He just hoped that the warning would come in time for those folks in Texas who had no idea what loomed over their heads. McCabe arrived at the giant Megamart distribution center at Alliance Airport about 10 minutes before 8 o'clock. He was scheduled to leave the center at 8 a.m. But as so often happened with last-minute shipments, it was a few minutes after 9 o'clock when he finally drove out of the distribution center. The sun was shining. It was a chilly but beautiful autumn day. He thought about calling Terry to let her know he was on his way, but he didn't really see any point. Calling her could wait until he was at the store and delivered his load. Then he would be through with work and ready to spend the rest of the day with his family. The Ultra Megamart was less than 5 miles from the distribution center, and it should have taken only a few minutes to drive there. McCabe suppressed a groan as he reached the interstate and saw nothing but brake lights and bumper-to-bumper traffic. He knew why. Everybody wanted to go shopping. His mind worked quickly, trying to figure out an alternate route. Unfortunately, there wasn't one, he admitted to himself a few moments later. He could circle around on some back roads and come up toward the store from the south, but the traffic from that direction would be just as bad, if not worse. Like it or not, he was just going to have to be patient and fight his way through the traffic jam. It took him 5 minutes just to get through the entrance ramp onto the highway. He bowled his way into the line of vehicles. He knew people resented truckers for doing things like that, but it wasn't his fault what he was driving was 10 times bigger than what they were driving. Let them try to maneuver one of these behemoths and see how they liked it. The traffic's pace picked up a little, and when McCabe checked the speedometer, he saw he was going 10 miles per hour. At that blazing rate, he'd reach the Ultra Megamart in 30 minutes or so. He looked at the clock on the dash. 9:20. He ought to be there by 10. He wasn't running that awful late. Shouldn't be any big deal. At 9:25, a dark-haired man pulled into the parking lot of a bank in one of the suburbs just north of Fort Worth. He brought his late model car to a stop in a place right next to the sidewalk, less than 15 feet from the front door. The bank wasn't very busy yet this morning. The man got out of the car and walked to a strip shopping center about 50 yards away, as if he intended to run a few errands first, and then return to the bank to finish up his business. But as soon as he was in the shopping center parking lot, another car pulled up beside him. He opened the passenger door and got in. The second car drove away. The first one sat at the bank. No one paid any attention to it. At a post office a few miles away, another dark-haired man parked in a handicapped spot at the street curb in front of the door. A bright blue handicapped parking hanger dangled from the rearview mirror of his van. He got out, not appearing to be disabled, but of course it was possible he had heart trouble or some breathing difficulty or some other medical condition not readily apparent. Certainly none of the people going in and out of the post office challenged his right to park where he did. Once inside the building, he didn't go to the busy counter, but remained in the lobby area where several alcoves full of post office boxes were located, along with coin-operated stamp machines. He went to one of the machines, studied it for long moments, as if he were trying to make up his mind exactly what he needed to buy. Finally reaching a decision, he fed coins into the machine, pushed the appropriate buttons, and took a book of stamps from the trough at the bottom where they dropped. He slipped the stamps into his pocket and walked out of the post office. A car pulled up at the curb. The man climbed into it, and the driver drove away. The van, with the handicapped hanger on the mirror, remained outside the post office front door. A few miles from the post office, the morning rush was over at the Little Friends Daycare Center. A few moms on later schedules would be dropping off kids throughout the morning, but for the most part, the children were already there. None of them were supposed to be picked up until nearly lunchtime. The center wasn't as full today as usual. Some of the parents took the entire Thanksgiving weekend off from work and kept their children home today, or took them with them on short trips. But still, there were about 60 children inside the building, along with 5 workers. None of them noticed the man who pulled his car up at the end of the building at 9:35, then got out and walked away quickly, leaving the vehicle there. There were no windows at that end of the building. Were anyone inside the enclosed playground at the rear of the center, they might have noticed the man or the car, but the playground was empty at the moment. The kids would come out later, once the temperature warmed up some. At least, that was the plan. He knew the American police were dolts, but even they might become suspicious of a vehicle parked in front of their building and quickly abandoned. The chance of that happening, slim though it might be, could not be taken. So the driver's life was now numbered in minutes. Three. 3 minutes from paradise. 3 minutes from a reward so glorious he could barely conceive it. And he would die too with the knowledge that he was striking a blow for Allah as a soldier in the holiest of wars. The trunk and the back seat of the car were packed with enough explosives to level the building. All the infidels inside would die. All he had to do to accomplish this was to drive the car right at the entrance of the police station, crash through the glass doors, on into the lobby, and trigger the detonator he held in his right hand. He pushed the button down with his thumb and set the switch. Now all he need do to cause the massive explosion was release the button. If he was injured in the crash, if the police managed somehow to shoot him, it would not matter. Allah's will would still be done. Less than 2 minutes now. With his left hand, the driver wiped away the sweat covering his brow. Even though he was willing to die, no, eager to die, ending one's own life was a hard step. He knew Allah would give him the strength he needed to carry out his mission, though. He shifted the car out of park, put it in drive, rolled carefully to the exit from the drugstore parking lot, stopped, and waited. He looked both ways along the four-lane street running between the drugstore and the police station, waiting for traffic to clear. This was a busy boulevard, and the driver grew impatient as he waited for a clear enough opening in the oncoming cars. He must build up some speed before he hit the entrance doors, which were probably more reinforced than they looked. Where were all these damned Americans going? It was 9:45 on a Friday morning. The road shouldn't be this busy. Even though the explosion wasn't timed to the second, since he was going to detonate it manually, he was eager to get on with it. The dashboard clock in the car now read 9:45. The other three bombs would be going off now. He had to do his part. He couldn't fail. He just couldn't. There were virgins waiting for him in paradise. Sweat drenched his face. His lips pulled back from his teeth. His desperate eyes spotted a gap in the traffic. He jammed his foot down on the accelerator. He never saw the concrete truck coming from the other direction. It pulled out from a side road and wasn't there the last time the driver looked that way. The truck hadn't built up much speed, but it was moving fast enough. The terrorist started to turn his head. Even as he did, a terrible impact smashed into him, racking him with more pain than he dreamed possible. In his last coherent moment, he was aware of his thumb slipping off the detonator button. There was a blinding flash he knew heralded his arrival in paradise. But if that was true, where were the virgins? Why did everything hurt so? Why did his body blaze as if it were burning with a never-ending fire? No one heard his scream.
When was Dad gonna call us?
Ronnie McCabe and her mother made their way along a crowded aisle in the craft section. Terry was looking for some needlework she could use as a spare present if she needed one. You never knew when somebody extra, a visiting aunt or somebody like that, was going to show up at a Christmas party.
He said he'd call and find out where to meet us when he gets through making that delivery.
Terry glanced at her watch.
Oh, it's 9:45 already. He should have been here by now.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Well, he must have been delayed for some reason. You saw how terrible the traffic was earlier. It's probably worse now. He may be sitting out there on the highway in his truck, not even able to get into the parking lot.
So we just wait for him to call?
We haven't even gone through half of the store yet. I think we still have enough shopping to keep us busy for a while.
That was certainly the truth. Once inside the cavernous store, it seemed endless, as if you could wander around in here for days and still not see everything there was to see.
Hey, there's Allison. Oh, look, that lawyer guy is still hanging around her.
Terry looked where her daughter was pointing, and saw Allison Sawyer making her way toward the shoe department, which was next to Kraft's. Alice Burke was still with the younger woman, smiling and talking to her. Terry thought Allison looked a little distracted and annoyed, but she was trying not to show it. Earlier, when they first made it through the doors into the store, Allison attempted to go her own way, thanking Burke with finality in her tone that made it clear Despite the gratitude she felt toward the attorney for his help in recovering her purse, that was the end of whatever relationship they had. Burke was oblivious. Or rather, thought Terry, he chose to be oblivious. He was going to continue his single-minded flirting with Allison, no matter what she said or did. Terry decided she and Ronnie would stay with Allison too, in hopes Burke would get tired, give up, and leave them alone. Things didn't work out that way. The Ultra Mega Mart was so crowded, Terry and Ronnie got separated from Allison and Burke in the press of people. It was all they could do to keep up with each other in the mob.
Let's go see if we can give her a hand.
Yeah, I guess Mr. Burke's a nice enough guy, but the way he's following her around and all but drooling is a little creepy.
They slid along the aisle, winding their way around customers' baskets, and intercepted Allison and Burke.
Hello again.
Hi.
Allison looked relieved.
Hello, ladies.
Mr. Burke, did you find what you were looking for your daughter?
No, not yet. I've been busy helping Allison here with her shopping.
He hefted the armload of toys and clothes he was carrying.
Yes, Mr. Burke's been very helpful.
Ellis, I told you, call me Ellis.
All right. I don't know what I would have done without your help today, Ellis.
He beamed, obviously pleased.
Well, I'm just glad I was here to lend a hand when I was needed. First stopping that purse snatcher and now serving as pack mule.
Oh, Ronnie and I could help Allison carry her things. Oh, that way you could get on with your own shopping, Mr. Burke.
Terry reached for the merchandise he was holding.
No. That's not necessary, really. It's no bother at all, I assure you. I'm in no hurry. I have all day.
But what if that toy sells out that your daughter wanted?
For a second, a worried frown crossed Burke's face. Clearly, he hadn't considered that possibility. But then he shook it off.
If that happens, I'll just get it to somewhere else. You know, I may have to pay more for it, but that's all right. I can afford it. I'm a lawyer, you know?
Yes, of course.
Terry thought Allison was trying hard not to grit her teeth.
You know, there's a restaurant in the back of the store. Why don't we go sit down and get a cup of coffee or something? I wouldn't mind getting off my feet and out of this mob for a while.
Sitting down sounds good, but I don't think we'll get away from the mob. I'll bet the restaurant is just as crowded as the rest of the store.
You're probably right. Let's go find out.
The four of them started toward the rear of the store.
That's probably Dad. If it is, I'll tell him to meet us at the restaurant. That'll be a good place to rendezvous.
The little group turned their heads and knew instinctively something was very, very wrong. But traffic surprised McKay by continuing to move fairly well. Not fast, but at least the mass of cars and trucks weren't at a dead stop anymore. He drove in silence, thinking about the leftover turkey and dressing sandwiches Terry would make for supper tonight. Sometimes, the leftovers from Thanksgiving dinner were better than the dinner itself. It was 9:50 when he pulled around the rear corner of the Ultra Mega Mart and drove along the back of the store toward the loading docks and the service entrance. He planned to pull right up to the entrance, but two dozen trucks already filled the docks, where they were being unloaded. McCabe found a place to park and climbed down from the cab. With his hands in the pockets of his jacket, he walked over to the stairs that led up to the docks and the service entrance.
Got another one for you.
The fellow who seemed to be in charge rolled his eyes.
Lord, is it ever going to stop?
The dockman consulted the little handheld computer he carried, checked some numbers he saw there with the numbers on McCabe's truck.
Okay, I got you here. We'll get to you as fast as we can, but it's going to be an hour at least before we get that truck unloaded.
Hey, it doesn't matter to me. Doesn't matter how long it takes. I'm done for the day. My boss is sending somebody else to pick up the truck later.
Lucky man. I'm not sure I'll even get time off to fart today, let alone go home and see my family. Hang on. Let me print out some paperwork for you.
McCabe followed the man through the service entrance into the vast stockroom at the rear of the store. The man printed up a delivery ticket from another computer, signed it, and handed it to McCabe.
There you go, pal. It's our worry now, not yours.
McCabe nodded and tucked the paperwork inside his jacket. As of now, he didn't have any worries.
Good luck.
He lifted a hand in farewell and walked toward one of the sets of swinging doors that led into the store itself. Just before he got there, the door swung inward, and a man walked quickly into the stockroom. He wasn't wearing a Megamart vest, which struck McCabe as strange, since only employees were allowed back here. Maybe he was a customer who got turned around and was looking for a restroom. Things like that happened all the time. McCabe went past him and shouldered through the doors without giving the man another thought.